My name is Edgar Mannheimer, and this is Kalam, a podcast about the Middle East.
You can see at that early stage of the Palestinian revolution, two competing trends. One saying that the road to Palestine has to pass through Arab Union, Arab unity. And then there's another trend that is saying the opposite, saying that in fact it is the liberation of Palestine that will lead to Arab unity.
That was the distinguished professor Khalid Fahmy of Tufts University, who we're going to get back to in just a minute. But first, we want to apologize for the poor sound quality in this interview. I promise you, though, it'll be worth it if you stick with it. If you haven't yet listened to the first two episodes of the Kalam podcast, we strongly encourage you to do so. In them, I give an introduction of myself. If you don't feel like doing that, I can summarize it by saying that my name is Edgar Mannheimer, a Swedish radio journalist with Jewish ancestry who grew up in the Middle East and speaks Arabic. Now, on to the show.
أنعى لكم يا أصدقائي اللغة القديمة والكتب القديمة أنعى لكم كلامنا المثقوب كالأحذية القديمة ومفردات العهر والهجاء والشتيمة أنعى لكم أنعى لكم نهاية الفكر الذي قاد إلى الهزيمة مالحة في فمنا القصائد مالحة ضفائر النساء والليل والأستار والمقاعد مالحة أمامنا الأشياء يا وطني الحزين حولتني بلحظة من شاعر يكتب الحب والحنين لشاعر يكتب بالسكين.
Friends, the old word is dead. The old books are dead. Our speech, with holes like worn-out shoes, is dead. Dead is the mind that led to defeat. Our poetry has gone sour. Women's hair, nights, curtains, and sofas have gone sour. Everything has gone sour. My grieved country, in a flash you changed me from a poet who wrote love poems to a poet who writes with a knife. This poem by Nizar Qabbani, considered by many to be Syria's national poet, is one of the better-known literary treatments of what happened in June of 1967. In short, after a period of military tensions, Israel launched a surprise attack against the combined armies of Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. It instantly destroyed the entire Egyptian air force by bombing its grounded planes. This left the Arab armies without air cover, and shockingly, they were defeated in just 6 days. Hence the moniker, the Six-Day War. These six decisive days resulted in Israel occupying Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights in Syria, and all Palestinian territories in the West Bank and Gaza. This is where the military occupation of Palestine begins. In Palestinian history, the tragedy of this event is second only to the Nakba of 1948.
War in the Middle East. Israeli forces drive spearheads across the Sinai Peninsula, west to the Suez Canal, south to the entrance of the Gulf of Aqaba, breaking the blockade, capturing the west bank of the Jordan River, and occupying the old city of Jerusalem.
Of course, the way we view the history of Palestine, and indeed Israel, changed on October 7. But if we stay in the 60s and try to understand what happened in 1967, we must first look at the development of the Arab world in the aftermath of 1948, the year of the Nakba, when 750,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes by Zionist militias in order to create the State of Israel. Egypt, Syria, Iraq, and Jordan went to war and lost. From an overpowering sense of defeat grew the determination to achieve actual, rather than formal, independence from the imperial powers of France, Great Britain, and the United States. It wasn't just the Palestinians that had tasted the bitterness of colonial dominance. Almost every single Arab country was either formally or informally controlled by European colonial powers, most prominent among them, France and the UK. Naturally, this birthed resistance. All kinds of isms from the far left to the radical religious right exploded onto the political scene. Eventually, most of them ended up coalescing around one figure, the Egyptian president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was a beacon of hope for millions of Arabs and who jailed many of his critics. In this speech, he reflects on the proverb, Al-Fuqara lihum al-Jannah, the poor will have paradise in the afterlife. He critiques it and asks why the poor can't be given a piece of paradise in this life, and in exchange, maybe the rich can take some afterlife paradise.
الفقراء ليهم الجنة والفقراء دول ما لهمش نصيب في الدنيا نصيبهم بس في الآخرة هم عايزين أيضا نصيب صغير في الدنيا ويديكوا أصادوا نصيب في الجنة.
Before seizing power in Egypt in 1952, when he and a group of military officers overthrew the pro-Western king in a bloodless coup, he was a soldier, and he actually fought in the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. From this experience, Nasser drew several conclusions. In 1955, he wrote in his book Falsafat al-Thawra, Philosophy of Revolution. I remember the days I spent in the trenches pondering over our problems. Often I said to myself, here we are in these underground holes besieged. We were cheated into a war, unprepared, and our destinies have been the plaything of passions, plots, and greed. Here we lie under fire, unarmed. Coincidentally, it was in these same trenches that Gamal Abdel Nasser heard the voice of another towering figure of the age, Umm Kulthum, singing on the radio. Umm Kulthum was the greatest singer the modern Middle East has ever known, and a powerful political force. We're going to return to her later in the show, but here's a snippet of her majestic voice, an unmistakable element of Egypt's soundscape to this day. By the mid-1960s, Egypt exuded confidence. It was the cultural heart of the Arab world. It was both popular belief and state policy to support Palestine. At the same time, Palestinian guerrilla groups were beginning to take matters into their own hands and launching strikes against Israel. It seemed a confrontation was inevitable. But when it came, the defeat shocked the entire Arab world. The extent of the shock is hard to overestimate. This is a clip from the Syrian movie Sandu ed-Dunya, Camera Obscura, from 2002, where a distressed soldier returning from the 1967 war tries to convey the magnitude of the shock, as well as its cultural significance.
من مسؤول؟ ها؟ كل مسؤول، كل فرد فينا مسؤول.
ماني مشوفك متهجر فينا. هنا.
ها أنت. ها. شو ما تعمله؟ شو ما تقدمه؟
Our guest today is the seminal historian Khalid Fehmi, Edward Keller Professor of North Africa and the Middle East at Tufts University. Khalid has written and produced invaluable content on the 1967 war. Our conversation begins with the political climate in the Middle East before the war. Ordinary Arabs and Israelis both thought that the Arab forces were far superior. But the highest military leaders, Arabs and Israelis alike, knew that the opposite was true. Before I play the interview, I'd just like to remind you that if you like the show, please subscribe to Kalam wherever you listen to podcasts. And please give us a rating. It helps others find out about us. And follow us on social media at Kalam Podcast. If you'd like to hear full-length interviews with all our guests, reading and poetry lists, and bonus episodes, or if you'd just like to support us, please consider donating to us on Patreon at patreon.com/kalampodcast. Now, here's Khalid Fehmi. What always sort of puzzled me is when you speak to both Arabs and Israelis that were alive at the time, It seems that ordinary Israelis, I'm not talking about people who had military intelligence, they were terrified. And they truly believed that Nasser and the combined Arab forces would win the war. And I think a lot of Arabs at the time, maybe bolstered because of popular culture that we might get into in a little bit, also believed that they had superior strength in numbers and weapons and all this. So how did it come to be the complete opposite of what a lot of people thought?
Yes, this is a very interesting side or aspect of the war. There is, on the Israeli side, a characteristic fusion of two sentiments. On the one hand, there is a belief of extreme vulnerability and a genuine belief that Israel is facing an existential threat. On the other hand, at the same time, there is also a feeling of invincibility, of superior strength, and that we could finish off these enemies in no time. Typically, these two sentiments are divided in the sense that it is the civilians and public opinion and even the politicians thinking that they are vulnerable, that Nasser and the Arab world are out there to dump them in the sea. And whereas the military, knowing with military intelligence the weakness of their adversaries and their own strength, and having enormous self-confidence about their training, their armaments, and their weapons, and their readiness, they knew that the mission is a done mission even before the first bullet was fired. And that becomes clear in a very pivotal meeting that the head of the Mossad, the Israeli military intelligence, had on the 1st of June. Basically, he went to ask for American assistance, not military assistance, but diplomatic assistance. Basically, he was asking for the Americans not to interfere. And in the process of negotiation that lasted for a few hours, the Americans asked him, so how much time do you want? Basically, how much time do you want us to be silent before asking for a ceasefire? And he said 7 days. So the Israelis knew, despite all the rhetoric, that they could finish off the combined Arab armies in 7 days, which is what they did. But on the other hand, the Israeli public did not know this. And many members of the Israeli cabinet were genuinely concerned that what they are facing is an existential threat. On the other hand, in the Arab world, there's an interesting mirroring. Public opinion thinks that it's a matter of few days and we will be in Tel Aviv. Umm Kulthum, the famous singer, is famously quoted as in an interview with Haykal in a few days before the war, asking him this question, when will we be in Tel Aviv?
The man referred to as speaking with Umm Kulthum here is Mohammed Hassanein Haykal. I thought I'd devote a sentence or two to telling you who he is, since I personally find him to be such a fascinating character. He was ostensibly Nasser's speechwriter, but he was so much more than that. A brilliant journalist, writer, and thinker, Haykal was essentially Nasser's security and foreign policy advisor, as well as being his close friend and confidant. Haykal was also the editor-in-chief of Egypt's largest daily newspaper, El Ahram, and he lived to see the Egyptian revolution in 2011, far outliving his friend Nasser. Say what you will about Nasser's politics, his failures, and his oppression of political dissent, but Egypt hasn't had statesmen like Nasser and Haykal in a very long time.
She famously, I think on the 2nd of June, gave a concert, a very famous song, Raga'in Bukut Silah. It has another title, Allah Ma'ak, God be with you. You here is both Nasser and the Egyptian army. And it was performed live in front of a rapturous audience. People were applauding, again, thinking that in a couple of days, when the war is done, Israel will cease to exist. Interestingly, that song, you can see the clips of it on YouTube, And it's a remarkable video because the only time that we see someone sitting behind Umm Kulthum whispering in her ears the song, the words of the lyrics, because she hadn't had enough time to memorize it. So, you know, these towering figures, you know, cobbled together this song in a few days to egg on and encourage the army. At the same time that there is this confidence on the part of the public, there are people who had serious doubts. And I think most seriously Nasser himself. And in my own reading, it was Nasser who understood that this is a dangerous gamble, and he felt pressured by public opinion. But he knew, he had always known that Israel is much more superior, that Israel has the capacity of defeating all Arab armies combined. And he'd been calling for caution in the repeated Arab summits. He was basically saying, we're not ready. We will not be dragged to a confrontation whose timing and place are dictated by the enemy. We should be the ones who should choose the timing and the conditions of the battle. So that split also between an overconfident sentiment and deep skepticism, we also see it reversed in the Egyptian situation.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. You mentioned, you know, these towering cultural figures like Umm Kulthum being so confident in the power of the of Egypt and the Arab forces, but I guess also of the cultural movement and the political movement at the time of Arab socialism and Arab nationalism. We're building up to the defeat, which looms so large in the sort of Arab psyche afterwards. But apart from sort of the big wigs and the big cultural figures, I guess I'm trying to get at how ordinary Egyptians, for example, or Palestinians for that matter, or other Arabs, how politicized this generation was. It brings to mind the novel by Sonala Ibrahim, Warda, from 1992, which is a kind of retrospective on this era of a deep politicization. Many people were sort of aware and engaged in regional politics, or at least that's my take on it. What did the movement of Arab nationalism and figures like Nasser and the Arab-Israeli conflict, what did it mean to people back then?
You're absolutely right. There's a very deep politicization, widespread, and it was genuine. The belief in Arab nationalism, the belief in Arab solidarity, and the solidarity with Palestinians and in their struggle was deep and genuine and widely shared. We see it in art, we see it in culture in general, we see it in people's parlance. Of course, also that was the rhetoric of the state. That was also the ideology of the state. And that is why Nasser continues to be adored and respected by Palestinians who'd never seen him. You know, subsequent generations of Palestinians, when they listen to Nasser and his speeches in solidarity with Palestine, they're touched by it because there's something very genuine, and that was state policy. So Egypt in the 1960s had a very flourishing cultural scene with regards to cinema, with regards to theater, with regards to song. I would also say poetry. I mean, I'm thinking about Salah Abdessabour and Salah Jaheen, you know, wrote about Palestine. Not because they got directives from political leaderships. This is a genuine feeling. It's interesting when we think about the mirroring image in Egypt and in Israel in cultural terms. So we had this song by Umm Kulthum. It's a very uplifting and confident and deeply felt lyrics. Then the defeat. She went literally to the basement of her villa in Cairo and basically sequestered herself for 3 days. She wouldn't go out. She wouldn't meet people. It was a deep cultural, political, psychological shock. She went in and shut herself up. Symptomatic of what happened in the country at large and in the Arab nation at large. How do we comprehend this shock? And how do we deal with it? After 3 days, she comes out with that determination that, okay, I am an artist, I believe in my art, I will use my art for the cause. That was symptomatic of what ultimately Egyptian society and larger Arab society and the Nasser regime actually did, which is, yes, we've been defeated, but we will not surrender. She and Abd al-Halim Hafez, the famous songs that they sang in immediate aftermath of the war that are about fighting, living to fight another day.
Yeah,
they're very sad. They're not all bombastic and hopeful. Abd al-Halim has, Abd al-Halim Hafez, the famous singer, Adda al-Nahar.
عدى النهار والمغربية جاية تتخفى ورا ظهر الشجر وعشان نتوه في السكة شالت من ليالي.
And then she sang the song by the أخوين رحباني, أصبح اليوم عندي بندقية. Not sure exactly the words.
أصبح عندي الآن بندقية إلى فلسطين خذوني معكم إلى ربا حزينة كوجه مجدلي.
On the Israeli side, there's an amazingly similar story, but again, the flip side.
Yeah.
It is a story about a song, famous song, that was sung on the 15th of May, 1967, on Israel's Day of Independence. Leading up to the war, the mayor of Jerusalem, Teddy Kollek, commissioned an Israeli poet, her name is Naomi Shemer, to write lyrics for a song to be sung on that day. And she wrote the lyrics of a song titled Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, or Jerusalem of Gold. And a young singer by the name of Shuli Natan sang it. And it was an immediate hit. And the song depicts Jerusalem as an abandoned city longing for the return of the people. And it has a very catchy tune, and it became very, very popular. And when the Israeli army was so successful, the 7th of June, they actually entered East Jerusalem, found themselves in front of the Wailing Wall. The soldiers spontaneously broke out into singing this song. And the song became so popular that in subsequent years, there were calls for it to be declared the national anthem of Israel. That didn't pass, but it is considered to be the non-official national anthem. The interesting thing about this song is that many years later, Shemer, the lyricist, the poet, she admitted to a colleague of hers that the music of that song had been, quote-unquote, borrowed from a Portuguese lullaby.
Okay.
And it is just remarkable when you listen to the original lullaby and the music of the non-official Israeli national anthem.
Yeah.
It's really plagiarized.
Wow. I'm going to play you the Israeli song Jerusalem of Gold first, and then I'm going to play the Portuguese song Pelo Johepe, and I'll let you judge the similarities for yourself.
Peyo Jose Petavernanda la Jauraja Yoda la Raulen Echera Juanda Esan Emendu Esdaneria Izanez Bere Ama Topa de Sala
aurorena eta zeindu ben.
So these two songs, in a sense, reflect the dramatic repercussions of the war, and that, in a sense, is reflective of the story of Nasser, the story of Egypt, and the Arab story in general. An admission of defeat, of course, it was termed in Arabic Naksa, setback, not failure, and even not defeat. And on the other hand, the Israeli song, in the wake of the victory, Teddy Kollek, the mayor of Jerusalem, who had commissioned the original music and lyrics, asked for two stanzas to be added that basically depict Jerusalem now as being redeemed. It was empty, hollow, and now it has returned to its rightful owners.
Yeah.
So he added these two lyrics, but interestingly, many years later, we discover that the music had been plagiarized from a Portuguese lullaby, and I leave you to make the implications of what this plagiarism indicates about Zionism.
Sure, sure. That was very diplomatically put. But it's interesting that you brought up the term Naksa, which I think was used by many people at the time. It kind of brings me to my next question about what happened in the subsequent years. But I also want to explore a little bit what the post-1967 paradigm meant for Palestinians and for the Palestinian resistance movements, and what kind of armed groups and organizations grew out of that?
That's a very important big question. And I'd like to start the story there before the formation of the PLO, before the formation of the umbrella organization called the Palestine Liberation Organization. There are many Palestinian organizations that were formed that are trying to find a Palestinian answer to the Palestine problem. And you can see at that early stage of the Palestinian revolution, two competing trends. One saying that the road to Palestine has to pass through Arab Union, Arab unity. And then there is another trend that is saying the opposite, saying that in fact it is the liberation of Palestine that will lead to Arab unity. And it is Arafat who's leading that second trend, but he of course needs Arab states.
Just in case anyone isn't familiar with him, Professor Fahmy is talking about Yasser Arafat, the chairperson of the Palestine Liberation Organization, until his death in 2004. He was the definite leader of the Palestinian political movement for decades, and it was his position that Palestine should be liberated by the Palestinians that won favor in the wake of the 1967 Arab defeat.
And we see this tug of war between the Arab states, most importantly Nasser, but also the Iraqis and the Syrians on the one hand, and the Palestinians on the other, in the early 1960s. And I think the first Arab summit were an attempt to contain the Palestinian liberation movement and the Palestinian revolutionary movement, because Nasser in particular was aware of the fact that he is not ready, that the Arab world is not ready for a military confrontation. He was very concerned that Palestinian guerrilla fighting would escalate, as they did in 67, in a war that he's not ready for. What ultimately takes place, the war 1967 resulted in what it resulted in. And when the Palestinians now see the utter defeat of the Arab regimes, the wing within the Palestinian movement that had always insisted on the independence of Palestinian decision, taking things in their hand, got much bolder, much stronger. And then the following year, they chose Yasser Arafat to be the head of the PLO. So the PLO now is dominated by Fatah, and it's dominated by Arafat, and that marks a serious move away from Nasser's domination, from the domination of Arab states, and that now the Palestinians will undertake the huge task of liberating the land using their own resources. And that is when many other organizations are being formed, the PFLP and others, all going into that direction.
What about ordinary Palestinians? How are they affected by this defeat and the subsequent occupation, military occupation by Israeli forces? Because while Gamal Abdel Nasser is considered a hero by many Palestinians, he's also kind of considered not so much a hero by others. How does this war live in the psyche of Palestinians, and how are they affected by it?
Well, the answer here is in the West Bank. Immediately after the war, West Bank is occupied by Israel. Israel is already ready with plans, from the words of Ilan Pappé. We now know that the Israelis had been working for many years prior to that with imposing a military rule. Military rule, incidentally, the contours of which and the techniques of which have been learned from the British, and how the British tried to suppress the 1936 Palestinian Revolution. So they basically copied the draconian measures of the British anti-revolutionary measures that they employed in 1936.
Back in the first episode with Saad Al-Amri, I spoke briefly about the 1936 Palestinian uprising. This is what Professor Fahmi is referencing here. In it, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians went on strike to protest the British and the Zionist project, and violence flared in the country. After a great deal of effort and the deployment of 100,000 troops, Great Britain finally managed to suppress the revolt. It took them 3 years to do it. It is estimated that 10% of Palestinian men were either jailed, killed, or exiled, including most political leaders. The brutal tactics that the British used in 1936 were studied by the Israelis and deployed to suppress Palestinian resistance following the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza in 1967.
One of the other things that happened, we now know from the work of Bilal Shalash, Palestinian in Gizeh University, that when they occupied the West Bank, they seized the records of the Jordanian Secret Service and the Jordanian police that have been spying on Palestinians. So that the Israeli military authorities now have a huge database of names and locations of Palestinians in the West Bank, and they go after them. The Palestinians in the West Bank attempt to resist the occupation, attempt to launch their revolution from inside the West Bank. There is a huge boost in the morale of Palestinians in the West Bank, strikes and civil resistance movements, but there's also military activities, guerrilla activities against Israeli checkpoints and centers of military occupation. The result of all of this is that the center of resistance, Palestinian resistance, moves from the West Bank and Gaza. The resistance moves to Jordan.
The Palestinian resistance moving its base of operations to Jordan was indeed significant. It meant that operations against Israel were launched from Jordan, and that other Arab regimes were funding and encouraging certain armed Palestinian factions in Jordan. The government of Jordan realized that Israel was not going to tolerate this and had no qualms attacking Jordan itself to pacify Palestinian attacks, putting Jordan's security at stake. As a result, King Hussein of Jordan executed Black September, in which a mini-civil war was fought against the Palestinian armed groups in the country, which eventually led to their exile. That's when they moved to Lebanon, a story we'll tell in the next episode.
But the idea of resistance is always there, and the idea that Palestine could only be liberated through fighting that ultimately results in a national armed revolution against the occupation. That is something that continues up to 1974, that mindset.
Yeah, and that kind of dovetails quite well into the next episode of the Kalam podcast, which is going to be about the First Intifada, which obviously happens way later, but is kind of a child of that attitude and that Palestinian retaking their own struggle. I know I've taken up a lot of your time, Professor, and I really, really appreciate it, but I wonder if I could ask you a last question. Are you surprised, considering the huge emotional toll and defeat that 1967 meant for not just Egypt, but the entire Arab world, that popular support for the Palestinian cause hasn't really wavered ever since. And I mean, it sort of remains unchanged.
I have to qualify this. I think there are ebbs and flows in this. Let's not simplify things. I genuinely believe that there is a hard rock of steadfast solidarity throughout the Arab world with the Palestinian struggle because of its justice, because of its nature, because it is, in a sense, the most just, in my mind and in the minds of many people, cause that we have in the world now and has been for the past half century, if not longer. There is something very genuine there. The solidarity is very genuine there. It can be deployed differently. And I think one of the things that Sadat managed to do in the mid-70s is to convince large segments of Egyptian population that Palestinians are responsible for their own calamity and that Egypt is paying an inordinate price in support of people who had sold their land. These are myths and lies and fabrications that the Sadat regime managed to propagate. And I grew up in Egypt, and I remember many, many large segments of Egyptian society believing in that. But that was short-lived. And it was short-lived because the dividends of peace did not materialize.
Right.
And the dividends of peace did not materialize because the nature of Israel has not changed. Israel as an expansionist, imperialist, military presence in the region has not changed. If anything, after the peace treaty with Israel, in between Egypt and Israel in 1979, that trend, in fact, got even more pronounced with the result of the invasion of Lebanon in 1982 and the many things that we saw after that. So the Egyptians are now, and Arabs, their solidarity with Palestine is not just sentiment, and it is not just about rhetoric. There are many people in Egypt now who think that what is happening in Gaza affects them personally, affects the price of bread in Egypt. So there is also a sober, realist calculation in which solidarity with Palestine on the long run is the only way out. And this kind of realist calculation is taking place in various countries because the regimes make their own realist calculation in the opposite direction. The regimes think about security and securitization. And here Israel, of course, has the trump card. Israel is the preeminent country in the world in using security as the main prism through which all its policies should be conducted. And these non-democratic regimes in the Gulf and in Egypt and elsewhere are bedazzled by Israeli intelligence, by Israeli tactics, by Israeli technology, by Israeli spy technology. And they have betted on an alliance with the Israelis against their own people, drooling in front of the Israeli military intelligence community and telling us, just give us some of your equipment, give us some of your contacts, give us some of your tactics. We will be your reliable lackeys. What I'm trying to argue is that actually to start with, the solidarity that Arabs have with Palestine is complex. It is not just about rhetoric, about a common past and a common language and the 1960s style of Arab nationalism. It is now much more sober. I follow diplomats in the Egyptian Ministry of Foreign Affairs who articulate sophisticated legal, diplomatic, historical, righteous position whereby Egypt's national security is best served by standing with the Palestinians. And they're not asking for war. They're not asking to abrogate the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, but they're saying Egypt has to put some limits on what happens to the Palestinians. Egypt has a responsibility for Egypt's own sake. Right now, we're seeing a degree of solidarity with Palestine that surpasses the solidarity that we saw during the Second Intifada in 2000. And let me just end by saying it is the Egyptian solidarity with Palestine in 2000 that started the mass mobilization of Egyptians that ultimately led to 2011 and the downfall of Mubarak. And the regime in Egypt knows very well the dangers to itself of allowing Egyptians to express their solidarity with what's happening in Gaza, because the minute they allow a demonstration to take place, it doesn't take long for the slogans to be directed against the regime. So they are aware of this, and this is why we haven't seen any mass demonstrations in any Arab capital, unlike the mass demonstrations that we see in all Western capitals over the past 5 months.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I witnessed that firsthand last fall in October, when there were some small demonstrations by some of the activists who had been active in the 2011 revolution in Cairo and in other cities that tried to organize pro-Palestinian demonstrations. And I saw how desperate the regime was to contain that, and how violently it was dispersed, and now it's kind of just contained to the press syndicate building. But certainly, questions of social justice in the Arab world and Palestinian liberation in my generation, in our generation, are certainly intertwined. With that, Professor Khalid Fahmy, I'm so grateful that you took the time to speak with me and be the third guest on the Kalam podcast. It was truly a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was the illustrious historian Khalid Fahmy, Edward Keller Professor of North Africa and the Middle East at Tufts University, and the third episode of the Kalam podcast on Palestine. I hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we're going to look at the Lebanese Civil War and the subsequent Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon, as well as the First Intifada, the great Palestinian uprising in the late 80s. That's next week on the Kalam podcast. And if you haven't already, I'd like to remind you to subscribe, like, and give a rating to the podcast. It helps other people find out about us. Also, please consider following us on social media at Kalam Podcast and sharing our content with friends and family. If you'd like to hear full-length interviews with all our guests, reading and poetry lists, and bonus episodes, or if you'd just like to support us, please consider donating to us on Patreon at patreon.com/kalampodcast. Kalam was written and hosted by me, Edgar Mannheimer. Research and production by Sam Karl Samra. Poetry reading in Arabic by Khulud Saghir. And sound design by Arthur Mannheimer.